All right. Back to going through the Bible, the Old Testament. Now, what, I haven't asked this in a while, what are the two main things we learned about the Bible?
They're all broken.
Everybody is broken and messed up. All right? And what is the other thing? That's about the people. What did we learn about God throughout? What's the story that we're going to learn about God over and over again?
Unconditional love, forgiveness. Mm-hmm.
Unconditional love. Man messes up, tries to walk away from him. God says, I love you anyways, but I am going to let you sit in the poop you just made for a little while, and you sit and think about what you've done.
Time out.
Time out. He can put us in time out. And as we found with Abraham, sometimes time out simply means he's not speaking to him. You know, or he's just having to deal with the results of what he did. Mm-hmm. So we, of course, end up like that too, right? Mm-hmm. You know, remember, we've also talked about grace and mercy. Grace and mercy, right? Mm-hmm. What is grace?
I answered the other two.
Okay, well, that's very, very close. That's very close. Grace is a gift that's given to us. The actual word means, let's say you have a king. You have someone of greater power and authority, empowering someone else, giving someone else beneath him, who is, you know, under his authority, the power to carry out what he wants them to do. Okay? It's divine, supernatural power that God gives us to empower us to respond to him in obedience. Now, wouldn't it be absolutely miserable if Christianity was a set of rules and regulations like in the Old Testament? Okay? Rules and regulations that you were not given the ability to obey? It would be like sending you to another country and telling you that you had to do a job there, but you'd never been trained how to speak or read the language. Okay? Or being put in a job that you've never been given any training for. Well, that's the frustration of the Old Testament of the people. Okay? The Ten Commandments, when we get to Moses, you'll find out, the Ten Commandments are not, these are the only ten rules you have to do. Later on in Leviticus, there's a zillion different rules. But the whole point of the Ten Commandments was that God said, bring all the people to this mountain, and I am going to talk to them. And the people said, they saw lightning, and, you know, they were very, very afraid to go to the mountain. And so they said, you know what, Moses? We'll wait right here, and you go on up. Now, along the lines of what you said early back in the beginning of Genesis, what if Adam and Eve had repented and asked for forgiveness from God? You know, what would have happened? Still, brilliant question. Well, it makes me wonder. He wanted to have a one-on-one relationship with everyone. They had a habit of saying, no, that's okay, you're a little scary. We'll just send this one person up there. And they said, Moses, you go up, find out what he wants. You come back and tell us, and we'll do it. So how can God tell the people what he wants each one of them individually to do if they won't have anything to do with him? All they want to do is have a man tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. Right?
Wow.
But what if? So how is he going to do that? He's got to create some kind of rules then. All right, the people don't want to come and have an individual relationship with me where I can speak to them and tell them and instruct them and empower them. Okay, fine. They just want a set of rules and regulations. That's what they'll get. But what if? What if they hadn't been afraid? What if they hadn't just sent Moses? What if they had gone up and met with God himself? And they would have heard for themselves and would have known him. And to know him is to love him. And would have surrendered themselves to him. And he would have given them the power. But instead, they wanted rules and regulations.
Can I share this real quick? Right here in this, I love this one. Free on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And the definition in here is showing love and kindness to someone who does not deserve it. The heart of the Bible's message is God's grace. And this is key right here. He loves people and saves them even while they are still fighting against him.
That's very good. But the actual Greek word for grace, see, most people think it's, you know, doing something for someone that they don't deserve. But it's more than that. In the New Testament, over and over again, Paul says, grace and peace be unto you. We're saved by grace through faith. We're saved by God's power through our faith in him. All right, so we've got a history where people don't want to have a one-on-one relationship with him. And therefore, he can't give them the power to do what he requires to please them. In the New Testament, all of that changes. Jesus says, come unto me, all ye who are weary, and I will give you rest. Mm-hmm. He says, I will also give you the power. He says, go. After I'm gone, you go and you pray, and the Holy Spirit, I'm going to send the Holy Spirit to you. And he will empower you to be my witnesses. Okay? Power. We get power from God. So we've learned that grace is divine or supernatural empowerment to obey God. And mercy is not getting the bad you deserve. Not getting the bad things you deserve because of what you did. Not getting the bad consequences. Consequences to your actions. All right? Now, I just wanted to bring those things up because those are the four most important things you learn in the Bible. Now, we have gotten to the point where Isaac has been offered on the altar by Abraham. That was the supreme sacrifice, a father laying his son on the altar. And actually, his son was a teenager at that point. And a teenager could have overwhelmed his 100-and-some-odd-year-old father, 113 or 126-year-old father. So that means Isaac must have allowed himself to lay down his life, just like Christ did for us. So, as we know, God sent a ram in the thicket, just as the angel said, stop, just as he was about to plunge the knife. Abraham was going to do that to Isaac. He stopped him, provided the sacrifice, and God said, I know that you will not withhold even the thing that is not only most important to you, but you are willing to give up my promise to you. What I promised to you. And it says in the New Testament, Abraham thought, well, you know what? God has made a promise. He is faithful. So even if I kill him, I guess he'll raise him from the dead. Mm-hmm. That's how much faith he had in God.
Oh, yeah, my kids would look at me like I was crazy. You want me to do what?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we've passed that. Now Isaac, Abraham is old, and his wife Sarah dies. And this is just some interesting stuff for you to understand. The scripture says that the elder over the house. Oh, no, I guess I've already talked to you guys. Did I already tell you guys about the death of Sarah? About the thing about the hand under the thigh?
No.
Ah, that's interesting. I thought I had taught about that. Sarah dies, and there was a particular place where Abraham wanted to bury her. And so he went to the man who owned that place, and he went to him and he said, I want to buy that as a burial place for my wife. And he goes, no. I won't sell it to you. You can just have it for free. And Abraham says, no, I will pay you for it. No, you can have it free. And he goes, I will not do this. You know, how much? And finally he says, well, if you wanted to give this much. And I always thought, well, that's kind of weird, you know. Ends up that was the custom of how you buy things at that time in the world, in the Middle East. You would say, no, 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 you don't have to pay me for it. And the other person would say, oh, yes, I will pay. How much will it? Mm-hmm. I never knew that before. So that was just very interesting. And let me see if it's, and then we'll go into the other thing. So in the end, back and forth, he finally got the place where they buried Sarah. So that was Genesis 23. In Genesis 24, this is where it starts out and it says, the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. So this is a time after he had tried to sacrifice Isaac. And now he's looking at his life. He's looking at his son, who is a grown man. And he calls the eldest servant to him. And remember, he was worried in the beginning. He says, if I don't have an heir, everything's going to go to my eldest servant. Mm-hmm. And that's when Sarah gave Hagar to Abraham. And they had Ishmael. So he called his eldest servant to him and he says, I absolutely do not want my son Isaac to marry anyone from this land here. Because they were people who worshipped other gods. And so he said to his servant, I want you to go back to the land of my people, where my family is, and find a bride for Isaac. And he says, where is it? He says to the servant, place your hand under my thigh. Okay? Place your hand under my thigh, which meant loins. It actually, it's meant to refer to the circumcised part of the body, which refers to the oath made between God and Abraham and descendants. Isn't that weird? So the same way that circumcision, remember, was a sign that this is a covenant between all of the men and God, that they belong to him. So then there became a custom that you put your hand near the circumcised part. That was your way of making a covenant with someone else.
So instead of shaking hands,
You're kind of, yeah, putting your hands there. So, yeah, interesting stuff in this, huh?
Yeah.
It's really weird. Yeah, I think we'll stick to that. So Abraham tells the servant to go back to Abraham's homeland to find Isaac a bride, but he refuses to let Isaac himself return to that land. He won't let Isaac go back there and pick out, because God promised to give Abram and Isaac the land where they now lived. And Abraham didn't want to do anything to jeopardize Isaac receiving the fulfillment of God's promise. If anybody believed in the fulfillment of God's promises, it was Abraham. Yes. I mean, he is how old now? He's 120-something or whatever. He has seen God's promises that long. Okay? And so he knows what's been prophesied, what has been said over his son. He's not going to take any chance of something happening to his son. So he's sending his most trusted servant, the one who has authority over the whole household, underneath Abraham. In addition, he knew Isaac should not marry anyone from the land where he currently lived. Marriage rites performed for Canaanites would involve religious rituals that were not fitting for those belonging to God. And also, the Canaanites were degenerating into wickedness. Now, what's interesting is he believed that God would send his angel before the servant to prepare the way for Isaac's bride to be found, and that she would be willing to just come back with him and be Isaac's bride. Mm-hmm. And if the woman did not want to come, the servant would be released from his obligation. He says, what if she doesn't want, I don't find anyone, or she doesn't want to come back? Abraham said, you don't have to worry about that. God's going to take care of it. He's going to show you exactly who it is. Now, the servant is also a servant of God, believes in God, and we're going to see that as to what just happens next. So the servant devised a plan to find an appropriate wife for Isaac and asked for God to show him success in the endeavor. He would ask for water as girls drew from the town well, and if the girl also offered to water his 10 camels, he would know that she was the right girl for Isaac. So he goes into the town where Isaac came from. And there's always one well, okay, one well in the area. And the way that everyone got their water is they would send the women to the well, get it, and bring it back for the day. Normally it was done very early in the day, okay? This is important to learn something about that you've read about in the New Testament. When Jesus went, it talks about Jesus going to the well and meeting the woman who had five husbands. She was coming late in the day, or when it's the hottest in the day, because she couldn't go to the well when everyone else was there. She was a pariah. She couldn't be around anybody else because she slept around. She had other people's husbands, and so she couldn't be around anybody else. All right, so that's just something for you to understand. Later on, remember, everything you learn about the customs of the Middle East help you understand later on what's going on in the New Testament. So he figures, I'm going to get there, and when all of the girls are coming to get the water, and whichever one of them, I ask for water, and she offers to give water to the 10 camels, because he's brought a whole bunch of goodies, okay? He's basically a bride price, things to give to the family of the woman who's going to come back. So he's got a lot of stuff. Before he had finished speaking to God, he said, God, this is how I want you to prove to me, you know, this plan. Before he had finished speaking to God, Rebecca walks up. Now, this is one of those things that I love about God. You ever ask yourself, why do I bother talking to God, or why do I ask him or pray to him? Because he knows everything anyways, right? Mm-hmm. But God wants a relationship with us. He wants to hear us. He walked and talked with Adam and Eve in the garden. Mm-hmm. That's his desire for us. Even if he knows what we're thinking, he wants the interchange, the exchange. If my almost three-year-old grandson, I know when he comes to the house, what he wants is the choo-choo. He wants the Elmo train set. He wants that taken out. I know what he wants to do with it. And yet he's learning how to talk. So even though I know what he wants, I still want to ask him the question because I want to hear what he has mm-hmm. to say. Mm-hmm. I love hearing those words, you know, mm-hmm. and how he's mm-hmm. coming to put words together in a sentence. There's a joy I get as a parent. Mm-hmm. Hearing my child speak, my daughter would call. And one of the things I learned about 20 years ago was from a book called Understanding How People Misunderstand You. And I'm going to teach that. I think this year I'm going to teach this. And what it is the personality profiles, the DISC mm-hmm. profile, which tells about the different people, how they act, why they act, how they... And one of the things I found out about my daughter was that she is an I. She is an influencer. She's a talker. Mm-hmm. And basically, her love language is, when she talks, you listen to her. Well, up until this point, I am a C. I am a perfectionist. I am a conservative person. I'm all about tasks. My daughter is all about people. So she would talk, and I wasn't that interested. You know what I mean? But the moment I learned that listening to her talk makes her feel loved and important, mm-hmm. from that moment on, anytime my daughter wanted to talk to me, I dropped everything else and just sat there and let her talk. Mm-hmm. And it's that same kind of way with God and us. Mm-hmm. Even though he knows what we're thinking and what we want to do, he wants to hear us. He loves the words. And mm-hmm. he wants us to know and feel how loved we are because he has set everything aside to listen to you. Mm-hmm. And I'll teach you something else. If you've ever read, anybody here ever read Mere Christianity? C.S. Lewis? Mm-hmm. Little book, great book. C.S. Lewis's books are fabulous. And they're not big, They're stories, allegories, a lot of them, of Christ, and they just help you understand Jesus and Christianity and all sorts of stuff.
Did you say anything?
C.S. Lewis. Mm-hmm. In Mere Christianity, I always wondered, how can God hear everybody's prayers all at one time? Mm-hmm. Well, he has an example. So interesting. By the way, he was a professor of literature in a school at the same time as Tolkien. Tolkien wrote Lord of the Rings. C.S. Lewis wrote a bunch of books, kind of like in the same vein, only Christian. So, this is what he says about how God can hear everyone's prayers. Imagine you are an author, and you're sitting at the computer, and you are writing a story. Mary got up from the kitchen table and opened up the refrigerator and took out the bread and the mayonnaise and the bologna and the mustard and put it on the table. And then you stop and you close the laptop and you go out and you meet some friends and you go have dinner and you come back and next day you go to work, you do something else. And you come back that night and you go, you know what, I want to work on that story. You open up your laptop. She took the ham, the bologna, back space. No. She put the mayonnaise and the mustard on the bread. She put the bologna on it. She sat down at the table and started to eat. Now, in your world, how much time has passed from the time you closed the laptop and then opened it back up? A day and a half, right? So in other words, there is a timeline in the story. But are you in that timeline? Are you physically in that timeline? Meaning, no, you can go back several pages and go back into the story and change something over here, right? Mm-hmm. Or you could decide, you know what, I know how I want the ending to be. And you can jump ahead and put the ending in. Mm-hmm. You are not limited by the timeline of that story. You're outside of the timeline, okay? But to the person in the timeline, they can't possibly understand that you're outside the timeline, right? She doesn't know there's an author. Mm-hmm. This is a storyline. In that same way, we are, our lives are in a timeline. Mm-hmm. He's the author. He can go back in the story. He can write the end of the story. He can stop. So that helps me understand that when I'm praying, he's outside of time. Everybody else might be praying at the same time, but it doesn't matter. He can stop, listen to this person, because the timeline, he closes the laptop, and he listens to me, and he listens to Sherry, and he listens to Lori. You follow what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's outside of a timeline. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
Omnipotent.
That's right.
And is without limit.
He is infinite.
He is without the ability. He has the ability to hear all, in all, with all.
Yes, omniscient.
For all.
Yes, he is omniscient. He is able to know that. But not only because he's outside of time, but also he created us. Mm-hmm. He knows what we're going to think tomorrow. He knows what we're going to do tomorrow. That's such a weird concept for those of us trapped in a timeline. Mm-hmm. But that's how he can hear it. So I bring that up because as the servant is speaking to God, even as he's talking, before he finishes, Rebecca shows up. And guess what Rebecca does? He asks her for some water, and she says, I'll give you water, and besides that, I'll water your 10 cows. Mm-hmm. So I love this because besides God wanting a relationship with us, he already has a plan for us. He wants to tell us about that plan, but he also wants us to participate in that plan, be willing participants in making his promises come true. Beautiful Rebecca came out. The servant quietly watched Rebecca to see if she would do what she said. That's the other thing. She said to him, I will bring you some water, and I will water your 10 camels. How many people do you know will tell you what they'll do and then not follow through?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So what's interesting is she said it, but was that good enough? That she said she was going to do it? So he sat back and watched her to see if she would do what she said. There's a lesson in there. There's a lesson in there because you can't trust what people say. You trust what people do. And that's why on both sides of it, there are people in our lives that we really should not trust because they have not proven themselves. And the other way, we have not been faithful to some people. But then we get all bent out of shape because they don't trust what we say. But we haven't necessarily proven them in that area. We haven't been faithful or consistent. So it's okay for people to watch us and learn from our actions and not just go by our words. And we need to be careful with other people too. When the camels had finished drinking, he took a gold ring for her nose and two gold bracelets and asked if the girl's family could lodge him and his camels, and she responded that she was basically Abraham's niece, Isaac's first cousin. And this was normal as far as in marriage customs went. It's not quite inbreeding, it's not the sister, but it is a cousin. So God knew what Abraham needed. He knew that he wanted to keep it in the family, and he directed Rebecca to show up at just the right time and do exactly what the servant had set up for the test. Nose ring. Now I'm like, a nose ring? It's half an ounce in weight. It was hung not from the central cartilage of the nose, but from the left nostril, the flesh of which was pierced for the purpose. Such rings are still the usual betrothal present in Arabia and are commonly worn both there and Persia. So on the left side, so he brought to her, after she did this, gave her a half ounce gold ring. And their noses, I guess, were already pierced for that purpose, I guess. Learned a lot of interesting stuff in this. And that's what you'll see. In response to hearing this, the servant worshipped God, blessing him for showing Abraham loving kindness and helping the servant to find a beautiful girl of integrity for Abraham's family. The servant explained the situation to her brother, Laban. Does anybody know who Laban is? Laban, we're going to find out later on, is big, very, very big in Israel and Esau and Israel, Jacob, Esau and Jacob, because he's the one who is going to be a deceiver and cause Jacob the deceiver to have two wives and have to work for the woman he loved for 14 years.
Oh, that's right.
So, but this very interesting things we're going to find out. So he's introduced here, and that is her brother. And her father was Bethuel, and they believed it was the Lord's will that Rebekah go with the servant to be Isaac's bride. So the whole family is, we're cool with this. The servant's response, again, was to worship God. Notice every time that God proves himself and provides, there is a stop and there is a worship. What does it say to us about how we should be going through our day? Every time God does something for us is an opportunity and a time for us to stop and worship him. And not just to praise God, thank you, Jesus, but really to stop and worship him. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be in song. I mean, it can be. But to really, at that moment, the word worship means to ascribe worth to someone. And when we worship God, we're seeing everything else in our lives is minute, it's minuscule, it's so much smaller and not worth as much as God. That's why with our tithes and offering, those are acts of worship. And that's why it says in Romans that To give our lives to God is our reasonable act of worship, also service. All right? So just realize, I hope God brings this to your mind the next time that He does something for you, that you take that moment and say, God, You are so mighty. You are so powerful. You are so worthy of my trust. And I thank You and I bless You for Your faithfulness in my life, for this one thing alone. You are magnificent. To magnify something, have you ever, you know, like one of those magnifying glasses, what happens is it fills the whole vision of that. For us to magnify God doesn't mean to make Him bigger. It means to look at Him so closely that He's all you see. Everything else just kind of disappears into the background. And you remember how big your God is. How many things do we face in life? I know that me, even with my addiction, all right, with my eating disorder, I just feel like, God, will I ever, ever be healed of this? I find I don't like myself unless I'm completely in control of myself, and God shows me over and over again, I cannot control. And that this decades-long addiction still has control over me. And so what do I think? All of a sudden I start thinking God is shrinking. He's getting littler and littler, and my problem is getting bigger and bigger. I'm magnifying my problem. But that's a lie. My God is still big. He's still huge. He can do anything. Just because I may be failing, it doesn't mean His power is failing. It means that I'm not accessing it. I'm falling back onto old coping mechanisms. So to worship Him means to let Him fill your vision and remind you what a big, mighty, massive, eternal, powerful God you serve. And that He will keep His promises for you. So remember that the next time He does something for you. Then He brought out beautiful and valuable gifts for Rebecca, her brother, and her mother. The servant wanted to leave immediately with Rebecca, but her mother asked that Rebecca stay for 10 more days. But they let Rebecca decide. Now here is a girl, a maiden. She's a virgin. She's never been anywhere but this little town. She's been with her mother and father. And now she is offered to be married to someone she's never seen before. And wouldn't you kind of, here's the mother saying, oh my God, I'm going to lose my little girl now. She's going to leave. She wanted her for 10 more days. I completely understand that. Mm-hmm. But the servant said, I'm not supposed to stay. So they turned to Rebecca and let her make the decision. And she says, I will go. Now, if that were you, wouldn't you be just a little nervous? You know, like those TV shows they have now where, you know, there's one where they bring two people, the parents pick out, and they bring them together, and they marry them, and they've never seen them before.
Yeah, that's completely different, though. These people knew who Abraham was.
Mm-hmm.
These people knew why Abraham was where Abraham was.
Mm-hmm.
These people knew Isaac.
That's very good. Well, they knew of Him. Very good.
Yeah.
All of these things. That's right. The same way that Abraham.
I wouldn't be afraid.
That's very good.
I'd be really excited.
Yep.
Yeah, because it's like God's promise in the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
It's
but we don't really know anything about her. You know what I mean? What her life was like. We can only guess. As far as what her life was like, what she knew about Abram. Although Abram was probably legendary throughout that area. I mean, he led wars, you know, led armies and won wars and had a lot of stuff. So she decided immediately, and she went with her nurse and her maid, so she wasn't totally alone. And I guess that's another reason why he had 10 camels. He had to bring her and her entourage back with him. Now, didn't that show faith? He didn't just go with himself on one camel. There are some people who just don't expect God to come through. And so they're not prepared when the promise is fulfilled, when He does it. I'm like, well, I wasn't ready for that to happen. If God told you, I'm about to sell your house, I want you to go looking for another house. And you go, I don't know. And then somebody comes in and says, I want to buy it and I want to move in next week. I'll pay you cash. You're not prepared. Mm-hmm. And later on in the Old Testament, I think it's Elijah, goes to a woman and she has oil, a little bit of oil in a jar. And there's a famine. There's nothing. And he says to her, I want you to get as many jars as possible. Just go out and get as many jars as possible and come back here. So she goes and gets, borrows jars and whatever it is from all the neighborhood people, and she gets it. He says, now pour the oil into it. And it was a miracle. For every jar that was, the oil kept pouring. And it only ran out when she ran out of jars. Okay? And he had said, is that all the jars that you have? If there had been more jars, you would have had more oil. Mm-hmm. So we need to be prepared. When God speaks into our lives, mm-hmm. we need to be prepared for him to move as he's going to do. Mm-hmm. It means making changes in our own lives, making places in our own lives. We're showing our faith in him by our actions. By acting according as if the promise was already fulfilled. So we're going to start acting like that promise was already fulfilled. And him bringing those 10 camels proved that he believed that God was going to answer that promise. Answer his prayer. When Rebekah rode up, Isaac, who was living in the Negev, I think that's how you say it, N-E-G-E-V, came out to find out what was going on. When Rebekah, she turned and she said, who is that man? And when Rebekah understood it was the man she was to marry, she covered herself with her veil, as was the Oriental custom. Now, I didn't know anything about this. I looked this up. A red veil is the bride veil that covers the whole body. I thought veil was just like the thing that covers the face. It's a red veil that covers the whole body, signifying she is the bride-to-be, while an ordinary veil is blue or white. So the other thing is someone she must have had either from her family or from the servant to given her a body-long veil that was red. So that way, when she put that on, Isaac would know he was about to get married, and that's who she is. But I never understood that custom. So the different colors of the veils meant something. After the wedding, the veil was rarely worn, which is why the Egyptians and Abimelech saw Sarah's beauty and wanted her. Remember what Abraham had that habit of lying about who his wife was? Well, since she wasn't wearing a red veil and completely covered, she was just wearing a white veil. It's saying that's why the kings saw her beauty and fell in love with her. Just thought that was interesting. The servant explained to Isaac what Abraham had asked and who the servant had arrived with. Isaac married Rebekah and loved her. Now, this is interesting to me. There are three states of marriage in the Bible. Marriage ceremonies that we have now didn't exist back then. Didn't exist at all. Now, we know by the time that Jesus was around, they would have a seven-day-long feast, you know, and there was more of a marriage ceremony. But back then, this is what happened. Stage one, signing the ketubah contract, creating a marriage bond. The bride would choose her husband, and her father would sign a legal contract with him called a ketubah. Once this is signed, the couple is 100% married, but do not have sex yet. Young children were often married, meaning the contract was signed, but did not consummate the marriage until they were old enough. So they would arrange marriages. So when the servant went to the house and Laban said, yes, you can have her, that was the first part of the marriage, right there. And notice it says the woman would choose her husband. She agreed to go. They didn't make her go. She agreed to go. So first was the contract. Stage two, the chuppah, which was sexual consummation. Up to 7 years later, the groom is able to raise the money as set out in the ketubah contract, notifies the father of the bride, who then sets a date to consummate the marriage at the bride's home. So you have a contract, with the family, the two families have a contract. Now then did you hear, up to 7 years later, the man had to work to make enough money to be able to buy the bride and support her. This is important because later on, I always wondered what was the deal with Jacob working 7 years for, not Rebecca, not Leah, he ended up with Leah. Oh, I'm drawing a blank. But anyways, for the daughter of Laban that he wanted, it says he would work 7 years. Well, he worked those 7 years, and then Laban deceived him and sent Leah in, instead of Rachel, sent Leah in.
Oh my gosh, that's right.
And covered in the veil.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So he didn't know who he was marrying. Now, do we understand the importance of the red veil and how it completely covers? Mm-hmm. So he marries her, she goes in.
Are you going through the Old Testament? Are we starting?
Yeah, we've been going through the Old Testament. Yep.
So this is just a continuing
yes.
thing?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's cool.
So that's why this way we understand all these different parts. So now I understand why Jacob had to work those 7 years for Rachel. He got Leah instead. And then he had to work another 7 years for Rachel. But he gave Rachel to her. But he still had to work another 7 years for Laban. Mm-hmm. But that was part of the marriage contract, of working in order to take final possession of the bride that you had a contract with. All right. The bride waits with her maidens for the arrival of the groom and his companions. The couple enters the chuppah room and consummates the marriage while the companions of the bride and groom wait and celebrate outside or in the next room. The groom hands the bloodied proof of virginity cloth to the witnesses chosen by the bride's parents, who then give it to the bride for safekeeping. Wow. Now, this stuff kind of makes sense. Contract, work, make money in order to support her. Then she is with her maidens waiting for this. And then the whole thing about the bridal cloth was that she was supposed to be a virgin. And if she wasn't, the bridal cloth would prove it. Mm-hmm. Right? They were paying for what they got. Mm-hmm. So, and the fact that the groomsmen and the bridesmaids were out there, you know, that goes to looking forward for Jesus. And it talks about, there's a parable that Jesus tells. And the groomsmen are there, and the handmaiden are there, and they haven't trimmed their wicks, okay? They all have candles, or they have lamps, and they're waiting for the bridegroom to come and get them and go to the marriage feast, all right? So this is everybody's waiting around to go to for the consummation. Well, they ran out. Some of them weren't prepared. They didn't put enough oil in their lamps. Because they waited and waited and waited. And by the time the bridegroom came, some of them didn't have lamps, couldn't go. A lack of preparation. So I know what it means spiritually. You know, it's a parable that's saying you've got to be prepared for Christ's return, for Him to come. And we're the bride, and He's the groom. And at the end, when we go to heaven, we're the marriage, okay, of the Lamb and the church, Christ and the church. But I never understood that this was actually what happened during that time in Israel, how people were married. Wow. You have all this group of the men with the bridegroom and these ladies waiting on the bride, with the bride, waiting for the consummation. Isn't that interesting? Learn all of this from here. So it just makes, later on when we get to the New Testament, that stuff makes sense. He was using examples of how they did everything then. That was custom. Then, stage 3, the wedding feast. After consummation, the entire wedding party walks to the house of the groom in a procession for a wedding feast. At the conclusion of the wedding feast, the couple has completed the ancient ritual of marriage. There was no wedding ceremony in the synagogue in the first century, performed under a, uh, performed under a canopy where the bride and groom would hold hands and say, "I do," before an audience of friends and family. This didn't develop for hundreds of years after Jesus died on the cross as the Passover lamb for the sins of mankind. So the marriage ceremony that we have today was not how it was before. So, anyways, that's just the stuff I wanted to share today. We learned a lot of things about marriage. We learned some things about customs. We learned about covenant. We learned also that when we ask God for something, we need to start acting out in faith and preparing to receive that promise for what God is.
Expect,
that's right. You know, in the steps for CR, it says that we, basically, we believe in God and we earnestly expect Him to do for us, to be able to return our sanity to us, mm-hmm. to be able to help us to do what we cannot do. That is putting our faith into action. And we also learned that whenever God does something for us, to stop and take time to really worship Him, mm-hmm. to remind ourselves, He doesn't need to be reminded how big He is, but to remind ourselves of what a great and mighty God that we serve, and He is faithful to do what we need to come through, that He will never leave us, He will never forsake us, and that He is worthy. So,
I have a question. Did I say capital?